This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a special tribute this week to a World War II veteran who left a lasting impression wherever he went. After featuring Dr. Fitzalbert Marius here on the radio a couple of years ago, I had the privilege of accompanying him to quite a few speaking engagements. And whether he was talking to teenagers, to fellow World War II vets, or to any age group in between, I got to witness firsthand his incredible ability to connect, to entertain, and ultimately to challenge all of us to be the best we can be. Dr. Marius passed away on April 10th at the age of 98. You can access his original two-part interview at hometownheroesradio.com. But we'll pick up his story with his joining the Army Specialized Training Program because of the accelerated path toward a career in medicine it represented.
That was in December 1942. I joined, enlisted in the Army under that thing. And at the end of my second year, they took me out of there and came down at Oxford, Pennsylvania, and picked us, all of us who had joined that program, and took us up to Fort Dix, New Jersey, where we would be interviewed. So I wound up at Fort Dix, and now this is very, very interesting, and if it hadn't happened to me, because as you know, back in that time, the Army was absolutely segregated. No blacks could be in a white organization, part of the Army, and on top of that, very few black officers. The officers over most of the black units were white officers who did not meet the qualifications to be over the white units. And they became the lieutenant and the captain over your units, like they were over mine. And they had certain kinds of things, myths and so on, during that period of time. Like, during that period of time, you only had four races. It's not like today, you know, with the multiplicity of stuff that they have. The four races, white, colored, yellow, and red. And you had to fall in one of those four categories. And there were no other categories you fell into. So, and blacks, of course, fell under colored. So I wound up there, I remember, going in for my interview. And they also had, there was a myth among the whites at that time, that you did not look a black male directly in the eye all for any long periods of time, because if you do, it was just like walking on the ladder or black cat crossing or being on the 13th floor.
Oh boy.
So they didn't look at you. Uh-huh. So when I went in, this white lieutenant was sitting on the other side, and I went in and stood up at attention, you know, and he said, not looking up at all, he's looking down at the paper, and didn't look up at me the whole interview, and says, relax, soldier, sit down. So I sat down, and I'm looking, but he never looked at me. And he began asking the usual questions, says, name, Fitzalbert Michael Marius. Now, that ain't a name like Jim Brown. And on top of that, I had a New York accent with some inflections of the West Indian accent in it. Sure. At that time. So I didn't say y'all, yes, boss, you know, none of that stuff. So I didn't have nothing Southern, nothing sounded like a colored man. And a name, Fitzalbert M. Marius? All right. Place of birth, Colon, Panama, not Biloxi, Mississippi. He went on down the line as education. 2 years of college. Now, most blacks at that time was lucky to make it to the fifth grade. And he just went on and on and on and on. And then he got way down to the, what you call it, do you speak any other language besides English? And I said, yes, sir, I speak French. Because I grew up speaking French. Now, none of these characteristics match anything colored. These characteristics are written down there are the characteristics you find associated with an intelligent white man. So after a while, he looked at the paper, and then he looked up for the first time, and you could see this, his eyes open wide, because what he saw did not match what was on the paper. So he said to me, he says, soldier, private, are you colored? And at that time, I was not very, you know, I didn't have the insight that I have now. If I'd have simply said yes, I'd have gotten into the program. But instead of that, I said, what do you think? And he looked at me and looked at the paper several times. And then he took out something and he wrote something on the paper and it says, soldier, you're discharged. You may leave. And I left. And the next morning, I was the only person of the group that received an order to get on a train to head for Denver, Colorado, at Fitzsimmons General Hospital. So naturally, I'm a soldier, I obeyed it. And I got all the way to Denver, Colorado, got to Fitzsimmons General Hospital, and it was a base about 1,600 to about 2,000 men. And I was the only individual on that base this color. Everybody else on that base was white. It was a 2.5 to 3 month program where they trained you to work with doctors on the field, you know, as a doctor's assistant, a nurse, you know, and so on down the line. So they put me in a barrack, and I was on the upper bunk, the top of the bed, and at the bottom bed was a young white guy from Georgia, and his father was the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan.
Now you got to be kidding me. I mean, all of this is hard to believe, but that one, I mean, what are the odds of that?
Yeah, well, the odds of this is, and like I said, if I hadn't experienced it myself, it would be hard to believe, with the Army segregated. So the whole time that I was there, the 2.5 to almost 3 months, I slept with the one eye open because they verbally abused me every opportunity you get. I can't tell you the things they called me. And whenever they got an opportunity, they physically kicked my butt. But just about a week or so before the time was concluded, six of them caught me off to the side by myself, beat my butt up really bad, and then grabbed me by the feet and had me hanging upside down, dipping my head into a barrel of oil where they were going to drown me. And fortunately, a captain came by. And naturally, you know, captain has to follow his orders and not allow any soldier to harm another soldier regardless, you know. So brought no charges against them at all. But anyway, after I left there, I went to Camp Barkley, Texas, which is outside of Dallas. And it was the first time, you know, I didn't know, you know, how did I wind up here in this situation? And naturally, the captain was a white captain, and he was also from Georgia, you know, and he was, then I'm standing at attention, and he's looking at the record, and he just fell out laughing. And naturally, I never changed the expression on my face because you learn as a soldier, you know, how to act, you know. And I just stood there watching. And then finally, after he laughed a while, he reached and got a big, long stamp, which was about 8 inches. And then he stamped right across the middle of the document, colored. And I said, oh, my God. This stupid lieutenant had put down there that I was white. And that's how I wound up in Denver, Colorado, because what he probably said to himself was this. Now, this guy was born in Colon, Panama. Now, he's of dark skin, but he speaks a different language and no color. None of these characteristics meets colored. If I'm going to make a mistake, I would much rather make the mistake the other way around than putting a white man with blacks. So when the Army was completely segregated, Fitz Albert M. Marius, for almost 3 months, was white. But it almost got me killed. It was the worst 3 months that I've ever spent in my whole life.
I'm just imagining you, as you described, six guys have grabbed you. So obviously, fighting back is futile. They've got you outnumbered. They've overpowered you.
Yeah.
And they're hanging you by your ankles, dipping your face into a barrel of oil. So what's going through your mind as that is happening?
I'm getting killed. That's what's going through my mind.
Yeah.
That's all that's happening. I'm not thinking of nothing else. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking I ain't going to make it.
How close do you think you came to being killed right there? I mean, how much longer would it have taken if that guy, the captain, didn't come by?
I don't know. You know, I have no idea of knowing. All I can remember is they were killing my butt, and fortunately the captain came by and my life was saved. Now, little details about how many minutes it was, none of that made any effect on me. Mm-hmm. The major aspect was my life was saved. Mm-hmm. And that's all I can remember.
And every veteran I've talked to, it seems like, has at least one moment where his life was spared. Most of those, though, are in the war, not here in the States before you ever got to war, because of this extreme case of mistaken identity that I guess really underscores, not to get up on a soapbox and not to be master of the obvious, but doesn't that underscore the fallacy and erroneous idea that these racist thoughts originate from? I mean, doesn't it expose how stupid racism is?
Of course it does. Of course it does. But it does not change the sociological and social system. Your social system changes from the heart, not from the intellect. You see, you can make all the laws you want. It will not change the way a person feels. They'll work around the laws. I mean, I found I did the same kind of stuff myself, working around the law. Now, before I gave myself over to Christ in 1967, I lived a life of what I would have called integrity, because I was always an honest man. I didn't lie. I told the truth. If I made a commitment, I kept it. Now, the commitment may not have been the right thing to do, but I kept it anyway, because I was a man of my oath. Uh-huh. My mother told me, Bertie, don't you ever make an oath you don't keep. You hear that, boy? Mm-hmm. And I can still hear her now telling me that. So I kept those kind of oaths. I didn't go out. I was raised Catholic. So marriage meant one woman, one time and stuff. So I wasn't out running after a whole bunch of other women or none of that kind of stuff. But I was just following orders. It was no change of heart involved. And that only occurred after I accepted Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior in 1967, in March the 3rd. And I remember that date very specifically because it was 2 days after my birthday, March the 1st. Mm-hmm. But that's where the difference came, remembering and having a change of heart. You see, not an intellectual attitude, but a change of heart. So anyway, when I wound up in the South Pacific and all those areas you read about, Guadalcanal and Bougainville and all those places, I was there.
Yeah. Well, and let's talk about how you ended up there. So they, so we don't lose a segment of the story here. You're in Denver. You almost are killed. They figure out this paper's wrong. He's clearly not Caucasian. Mm-hmm. They put that big colored stamp on your file.
That's when I went to Camp Barkley, Texas, and went through basic training.
With other African-American troops?
Of course. I was black again. I was one among the white folks no longer.
How was that different, being with an all-black unit and going through basic training with all black soldiers all of a sudden after the time you'd spent surrounded by nothing but white soldiers?
Well, the number one thing, I was not concerned. I could sleep with both eyes closed. and nobody was going to cuss me out because I was black. They had other reasons too, which they did later on, but not because I was black. After the basic training, which took about 3 months, they shipped us up to a camp in Pennsylvania. And then after we left there, then they shipped us down to an area right outside of Stockton, California, and they boarded us on a ship. We went from there, first landed in Hawaii. I finally wound up in New Caledonia. And New Caledonia is a French-influenced area. And it was very interesting because the United States of America had an armed depot there, that they collected things and then so on down the line. But they needed, translators. And, of course, they looked at my record. And even though the Army was segregated, I spoke French. So they put me in there to be as an interpreter to the people who in that area who were working there who spoke French. Now, the other interpreter who was there was a white lieutenant from Mississippi. As a matter of fact, he happened to be teaching language, and French was one of the languages he taught in the University of Mississippi. But he grew up in Mississippi. He had, of course, a Mississippian accent. So even when he spoke French, you heard the Mississippi accent in it. Like, if you want to say, do you want something to eat in French? Say, est-ce que vous voulez quelque chose pour manger maintenant? Okay, you want something to eat right now. Well, he said in his French southern accent, est-ce que vous voulez chose pour manger maintenant? First time I've ever heard French spoken with a southern accent. And they couldn't understand him. And they would turn to me and say, qu'est-ce qu'il dit? What did he say? But I had to be very careful. I had to whisper to them in French, I'll explain to you later. Because I didn't want to explain nothing in front of him. After, you know, he'd finished and told him all he wanted to do, then I would go off someplace and they'd follow me. And then I would tell them in French that they could understand. But I knew better to embarrass him. Because
sure.
He was a lieutenant, and I was nothing but a private. Mm-hmm. So anyway, after that is when we moved to places like Guadalcanal and all that sort of stuff, and there were all kinds of experiences. And since we had medical associated with us, they did not arm us.
And let's explain that for people listening. So you're an all-black unit. Mm-hmm. That is in the Pacific, and you're following along with the 1st Marine Division. You're attached to the 1st Marine Division. But what was your job? What were you guys supposed to come in and do?
All we're supposed to do was to take care of all of these things like disease, insects, and stuff like that. If there were some certain flies and stuff, we would, to get rid of them, we had the stuff to spray, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Dig the ditches, to drain the swamps, you know, and all that sort of stuff. That's what we did. And then of course, when things happened, to bury the dead. Now, what happened, as a matter of fact, it was in Iwo Jima. When we were going in the invasion of Iwo Jima, they had the two units. So one had to go in because there were certain insects and flies and stuff and that carried a certain amount of certain diseases and stuff that they had to go in to take care of. So they flipped a coin to decide which unit would go in. No, it was a straw, the short straw and the long straw.
All right.
So we'd pick the right straw. So they had to go in first with the 1st Marine Division. And there in Iwo Jima, they had caves up there, and the Japanese had the guns and all that stuff on tracks. They pulled them back into the cave. So even though they bombed all the areas and stuff like that before they sent the troops in, they had all the major troops and stuff all back there because there was an airport there that the United States wanted to control and take over. But anyway, when they first sent the 1st Marines in, they also sent the 727th because the 727th lost and they went in. Now, there's 125 people belonging to each one of those groups. Only three of them made it back. All the rest of them got killed. Now, if we had gone in first, we would have only had three left.
Yeah.
So the Lord was looking out after me and that group. So, and a lot of things happened like that. And at Guadalcanal, almost got wiped out at Guadalcanal because there, the Japanese at that time, you know, had their planes, and we didn't have the fast planes to keep up with them at that time. And they hadn't just put them out yet. And so they would come in and they would bomb the heck out of the areas. And we were in foxholes and they bombed us for 2 weeks and stuff like that. And all kinds of people got killed and so on. But I made it through. And as a matter of fact, the Lord blessed the heck out of me because the whole 3 years or so that I was over in that South Pacific, I did not get one disease. As many enough of these mosquitoes as I got bitten with, I never got malaria. I never got any of those other diseases and all those other people got shot all around me, and I never got one injury. The Lord was looking out for Bert Marius because I wasn't looking out for myself.
I'm sure I'm not the only one who knew Dr. Bert Marius who's going to miss that characteristic laugh as much as anything. He beat the odds and made it through World War II, but not without some close calls. And we'll hear about that when this special tribute edition of Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.